Coming up on this week's episode of TechSnap, Cryptic Studios has suffered a database breach, but we've got more questions than answers. Critical infrastructure hardware has had another vulnerability discovered, plus a Wi-Fi hack that's so easy, it's fun. And we'll tell you why you might have had some troubles downloading Jupiter Broadcasting shows and the hardcore tech we're going to throw at the problem to fix it. All that and more on this week's episode of TechSnap. Hi, everyone, and welcome to TechSnap. This is episode 55 of Jupiter Broadcasting's weekly systems network and administration podcast. We recorded this episode live on April 26th and released it for download on April 27th, 2012. This episode is brought to you by GoDaddy.com, and I'll tell you more about them as the show goes on. And the live stream is powered by ScaleEngine.com, which is just so fantastic. I have to tell you about it all of the time. My name is Chris, and joining us every single week is the admin, the tech, and the teacher, Alan Jude. Hey there, Alan.
Hey, Chris, everybody. Thanks for watching.
Hey, man. Welcome back to TechSnap. We got a great show today.
Mm-hmm.
Not only do we have some news stories that I know are going to be particularly of interest to the Jupiter Broadcasting audience, but we're also going to get to a feedback question that a lot of you have been asking. Why can't I properly download the Jupiter Broadcasting shows, guys? So we'll talk about that. And also, we have got a rockin' roundup with some stories that I think you guys will be interested in, plus another CISPA follow-up. So stay tuned for all of that. But of course, we've also got our news docket. Yeah?
Yep.
I want to give one mention before we get rolling. We just added a new affiliate over the Jupiter Broadcasting site, so if you want to check that out, just go over to jupiterbroadcasting.com and scroll down to the very bottom of the website, and we now have a Gamefly affiliate there. So I don't know if Gamefly works in Canada, Alan, but Gamefly is sort of like a Netflix for video games. So if you guys want to check that out, just go over to jupiterbroadcasting.com and look for the Gamefly link. It'll be right there next to the Chrome extension, and the Firefox extension is coming soon. And thank you to everybody who uses those affiliate links before they shop to help support the network. And, you know, those kind of things help fund development and continued production, and soon bandwidth costs for these shows. So thanks to everybody who does that. All right, Alan, why don't we jump into our first news story today?
Yes.
A backdoor in mission-critical hardware threatens power traffic control systems. Is that really as bad as it sounds?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
There's a company called RuggedCom that makes little devices that run an OS called RuggedOS.
Sure.
And basically, it's a device meant to bolt on to SCADA systems and make them remotely manageable.
Ah.
Which is like the definition of bad idea.
Yeah.
But basically, it can take even SCADA systems that weren't designed to be on a network at all, that just have like a serial interface, and it acts as an IP to serial interface to allow you to remotely manage them.
Oh, okay. I see. So that way you can internet connect something that was never meant to be internet connected.
Yeah. And this device is supposed to provide the security. The problem is that it has a default backdoor / maintenance account that isn't secured properly.
Backdoor / maintenance.
Yeah. So RuggedOS devices are used to manage all kinds of things like traffic control systems for stoplights, railroad and communication systems, power plants, electrical substations, and even some U.S. military sites use them.
Oh, okay. So just a few important places, nothing major.
Yeah. So basically, the RuggedOS devices have an account built into them called Factory, which you cannot disable.
Nice.
And so that account is obviously meant to allow the manufacturer to service the device and you know, access it or whatever without having to know the passwords of the users on the device.
Right, right, yeah.
And so on.
And you wouldn't want the user to accidentally do something silly like disable an important account like that, because then the user would be, you know, up in S Creek and need help. So you got to make sure they can't disable it.
However, you know, it's not secure enough. So instead of using some kind of strong cryptography like SSL or SSH keys and certificates or whatever to ensure that you as a manufacturer can authenticate a user to the device, instead of that, they use a password which is derived from the MAC address of the device using a mathematical formula. So each of these devices has a unique password, but the password is just the MAC address run through a very simple math formula.
Okay. So something that once you figure out what the math is...
Yeah. then great. You can know the password for every one of these devices as long as you know the MAC address.
Jeez, great, great.
So the guy that discovered this wrote a little Perl script that does it. It's, you know, a couple of lines, and because it's Perl, it could be written in even fewer lines. But basically, if you take the MAC address, run it through this Perl script, it spits out the password to access the device basically as the administrator.
That's just fantastic. And Ars Technica has a screenshot of the output here. Is that what this is? Or this is
that's
like their
login screen.
Yeah.
And the most interesting thing about the login screen for these devices that are secured using the mathematical formula based on the MAC address,
yeah,
is that little banner that comes up when you log in.
Yeah.
It's like the fourth field down there. Oh, it's the MAC address of the device.
Yeah. Just tells you what it is right there, so you have it.
Yeah. So, you know, handy dandy technician guy connects. Oh, look, there's the MAC address. I'll run that through my secret little Perl script over here, and that'll tell me the password for this device. So basically, what it does is it takes the MAC address, reverses the octets so that it's backwards, but each octet stays the same, but the order of them is backwards. And then it treats that as a hexadecimal number. So turns it into a normal number, and then modulus that from a static constant. And that gives you the password.
Wow. Wow.
So first of all, that's pretty insecure. Secondly, it means that the password for every single one of these devices is at most 9 characters long.
Oh my gosh.
All the characters are always digits. So the passwords only consist of the numbers 0 through 9. And there can't ever be more than 9 digits. And in most cases, it's going to be 8 digits or less.
The chat room is like, why are they so dumb? This has got to be Hall of Shame material right here.
Yeah.
We got to promote this to the Hall of Shame. And the worst part is it's attached to this critical infrastructure equipment.
Yes. Basically. It looks like they added a couple extra zeros onto the end of the MAC address to make sure the password was never less than 5 characters. Because otherwise, it was possible that you would have a password of 1 or 0 as the password for one of these devices. That's how a modulus works.
Yeah.
Other problems is that it uses plain telnet rather than something like SSH.
I was looking at that. I was like, is that telnet?
You can just sniff the traffic. And a bunch of these are like publicly accessible on the internet. On Ars Technica there, they link to a search engine that allows you to search the internet for
devices. No way, really?
So they go around scanning the internet for, you know, what's on port 80, what's on port 23, which is telnet, and grabbing like the banner strings, and they're like, oh look, here's a router and here's somebody's camera.
So what should I search for? Yeah, I'm at it right now. It's like shodan.com or Shodan and, HQ.
Basically, if you look for, I think, Regicom or whatever, you'll find a bunch of these devices just out there on the internet. And now that you have that Perl script, you can go and hack them.
Hey, look at this. Yeah, this is great. Here's a park here in the United States. Should I take a look at this?
I have no idea. Huh. I didn't go that far.
Very interesting. I could have some fun with this. Oh, man.
So the researchers that discovered this notified the manufacturer about it more than a year ago. And after a while, they finally got a response that was mostly like, all right, we acknowledge that that's a bug, but they never talked about fixing it or anything. So there's a timeline in the link at the bottom there. But yeah, April 2011, they reported it to the vendor. In July of 2011, the vendor finally verbally acknowledged that the backdoor actually existed, but they wouldn't put it in writing, and they basically stopped communicating from then on. So in February of this year, the researchers submitted the bug to US CERT, which is a repository for these type of things. And it's meant to handle the dealings between the vendors and the companies and the manufacturers and so on. So then a month later, the vendor finally responds to the US CERT demand for information about it. And then no response again. So this company seems to have a habit of not answering their emails or something.
These guys are Canadian too, aren't they? These Canadians.
The company, yes.
Oh my goodness.
So April 6th of this year, because of the lack of further contact with the vendor, US CERT sets a public disclosure date of April 13th for this bug.
Oh, okay.
To force the, because the vendor's not acting, so they had to force the hand. April 10th, the vendor finally got back and asked for 3 extra weeks in order to alert their customers of the problem. Although they specifically, we're not going to fix the vulnerability in that time.
Hmm. So they know about it, but so at this point they admit they know about it, but they're going
to tell their customers, and they wanted extra time to tell their customers.
Okay.
But they never talked about fixing it.
Okay.
Because normally you would be like, we need 2 extra weeks to get this fix finished and push it out. But in this case, they're just like, we need time to tell our customers that they should probably unplug these from the internet or whatever.
Yeah, okay. Okay. All right. I mean, at least they're informing people, I guess. It should, seems like they should be fixing.
The US CERT asked for clarification about why they needed the 3 weeks and so on, and no response. So on April 23rd, because of no response, US CERT released the full disclosure of the vulnerability.
Uh-huh. Yeah, boy, oh boy. So are they now that it's out there in the public? Do we know? Are they submitting code to fix this? Are they going to? I mean, how could they even get updates to all of these devices? Department.
Right, because a lot of them, they seem to be on the internet. They probably don't have an automated update interface.
Right.
And, you know, if you look at that screenshot there, like, it looks like that version of the OS on that device that they have in the screenshot is from 2010.
Yeah. Actually, well, yeah, and the copyright's from 2008 even.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it says the build's 2010, March 5th.
Yeah. So this vulnerability was discovered by the researcher, but what he did was he was concerned about hearing all these news stories about the SCADA devices. So he went on eBay and managed to find a couple. And he bought them, and then he started analyzing the images of the firmware, and he basically found this factory account and the modulus he needed to run the MAC address. And he figured out how to log into them.
He must have been crapping himself when he had a bunch of different devices and he realized he could use the same account on all of them. I mean, he must have just been like, what have
I
just
uncovered?
Well,
I don't know if all devices he bought were for RegaCom, but basically he figured out how to log into the one that he had.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. That's a pretty damning...
It seems to be a new trend of researchers buying up used devices on eBay and finding vulnerabilities in them.
I guess what it all fundamentally comes down to, whenever we have the U.S. government arguing that we need better cyber controls because of critical infrastructure devices online, or when you see things like this, I guess I'm not connecting the dots to what is driving the connectivity of these infrastructure devices. Why are we...
Because you don't want to have to send a tech to drive over to some unmanned water pumping station to fix a computer. You want to be able to do it over the internet.
But why? Why not just for these types of devices say, well, their support requirements require on-site support?
Yes, that's what it should be. Or at least, you know, a VPN or something. It shouldn't be on the public internet.
Well, and the worst part is if it's online, they could technically outsource the support anywhere. I mean, it could be one of those deals where I have seen, like for example, where I go into clients' offices and they'll have support, or they'll have IT support that's from somebody that's on the other side of the country. And then what they do is they schedule a local tech within 48 hours to get out there and fix the thing that needs to be fixed. And it's just, that's what that leads to. That kind of remote administration just eventually leads to that kind of abstraction. And it just, for infrastructure, it just seems pointless and futile on so many different points.
Yeah. Hmm. And part of the reason maybe for the unresponsiveness of the company is because they were trying to, why they were trying to keep this under wraps so hard is because in March of this year, they were acquired by Siemens, the company that makes most of these SCADA systems that are getting hacked. And I'm sure it might have affected their sale price
Had
known that there was this giant vulnerability.
Yeah, yeah, got to get that thing.
And, you know, it raises some interesting questions as far as the business goes here is, you know, did RuggedCom do something illegal by not disclosing to Siemens that there was this vulnerability and that they knew about it for more than a year?
Right.
Ahead of this sale for
you would think so,
like a
right?
large sum of money.
You would think so. You would hope so.
Or was Siemens fully aware I was trying to keep it covered up?
Yeah. Well, that's probably likely because it would be detrimental to their business. Any other thoughts on that story?
Nope, that's about it. But I have a link to the full disclosure, which is rather short because everything you need to know fits in a couple of lines of Perl. It's like, find one of these devices.
Right.
Run this script against the MAC address that it gives you when you connect to it.
It's so simple. It's so simple. It documents itself.
You don't even have to ask it for its MAC address. It will just tell you unsolicited, hey, my MAC address is blah.
Thanks for logging in. Here's my MAC address.
Yep. And then, you know, you put that through the Perl script, and then now you have the password to take over the device.
And also, like, what also I love is, like, here's my version information, so that way you know exactly what vulnerabilities I might be susceptible to, so you can just narrow it down. I love all that. Here's
Although
as much information.
Very common. Almost the banner for almost every service spits out its version.
I know. I hate that. I hate that.
Yep.
But all right. So this next story is going to be especially applicable to anybody who plays Star Trek Online or Champions Online or has had an account with Cryptic Studios since 2010 or before. Cryptic Studios announced this week that they suffered a compromise and a username and password database leak. Now, I don't know what kind of details you've gleaned here, Alan, but I think it's probably good we cover the technical side of this so that way any fans that I'm sure we have in the audience to play that game can, you know, be as informed as possible. So what happened?
So Cryptic released a notice and started sending out an email, although the email seems to have gone into the spam folder for most people, including my Gmail. But basically, they're saying that in December of 2010, their database of login name, game handle, and encrypted passwords was compromised. And they just detected this recently.
Yeah.
Now, though by detected it, I think they basically figured out that somebody had access to the entire database at some point before this date, rather than actually found like a log of it happening or something.
And detected is still kind of a loose phrase too, because the actual wording that they use in their press release is it's kind of vague. It says they say we have no evidence that any other information was taken by the intruder, comma, it is possible that the intruder was able to access additional account information. If they did so, the first and last name, email address, date of birth, if provided to Cryptic Studios, your billing address, the first six digits, and the last four digits of your credit card registered on the site may also have been accessed.
So that basically that's other information that was also on that same server that was compromised.
Yeah.
So while as far as I can tell, the attackers have only taken and used the usernames or login name, game name, and encrypted passwords, because this other information was also on that same machine, they could have taken that as well.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm pretty sure Cryptic uses Microsoft SQL for their back-end database system. And I think we kind of had some suspicion that something might have happened a couple of weeks ago. Mav, who works with us on Stoked and is the leader of Jupiter Force, his account was compromised. All of his items in-game were cleaned out. All of the money was taken from the Fleet Bank, which was quite a bit of money. Also, around that same time, several other threads over on the Stove forums were popping up, making claims that their account had been compromised. So much so that people started speculating that maybe one of the popular Stove fan sites had been infected with a Trojan. People were kind of looking for scapegoats. It started to look to me kind of like something had happened, so I changed my password immediately. But people all need
because
to go out there
and do that. This is probably, you know, this kind of thing would probably be massively underreported because of the number of people, like, because this database is from 2010, how many of those people don't play the game anymore? And so when their account was compromised, nobody noticed.
Right. Or maybe their email address is out of date, you know.
Right.
So, because it's an old account. Now, the one other thing is...
The thing that made it suspicious was that because of the way the login system at Cryptic works is, your name in the game isn't the same as the name you log into the game with. You log in with an account name, and then you have your at name that you actually are known as inside the game.
Right.
So that people don't actually know what your username is just because they interacted with you in the game. And so... To get that username, which is also saved in the launcher.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, if it was a Trojan, yeah, we're pretty sure it's not now because of this, but if it had been a Trojan, maybe it could have read wherever that was saved in your browser. Mm-hmm. But if it was a keylogger, it wouldn't have seen your username every time because you wouldn't type it every time because it was saved in the launcher.
Right.
So that's why...
The keylogger thing sounded like crap to me the first time I heard it.
Well, because, you know, when we... talked about it a bit when Mav's account got hacked. It was like, well, the keylogger doesn't seem very likely because it would have to be highly targeted to take over your Stowe account, and they would have to know that when you randomly type in a password that that's the one for Stowe, right?
Right. And I'll be honest, part of that was an evaluation. It's like, would they want to compromise someone's Stowe account? Would someone go to the trouble to code into a Trojan to collect that?
Unless you're a gold farmer, the energy credits and so on you stole are not really that useful.
Yeah.
It's like an account in Stowe doesn't sell for hundreds of dollars like World of Warcraft accounts used to back in the day.
What I kind of like to take a look at when companies have a mistake like this, a misstep, is their communication. And I wouldn't say that I'm overall impressed with Cryptic Studios' communication. First of all, the first mention of it came in the Stowe form when they said that if you have a problem logging in today, your password may have been reset due to some maintenance that we were performing. Please reset your password on our website, and for more information, look at this link. And then that link took them to the press announcement about the issue. So the first word, the first line of communication is, we were doing some maintenance, your password got reset. Then after that, when they sent out the email to everyone, there is a grammar mistake in the first pair, in the first sentence even, and that just really, and I'm not Mr. Pronunciation or Mr. Spelling over here, but this is potentially one of the most important emails your company will ever send or has ever sent in the history of your company. And it reads, as a result of routine security checks and upgrades. All right, let's stop right there. This happened in 2010. There's nothing routine about security checks if it happened in 2010 and you're just now finding it in the middle of 2012. That or right. early
and
2012.
I think here, basically, they only found it because they went looking because they saw this huge swell of accounts being compromised.
Right. So they're being disingenuous, which I don't like that. Then they say, we have discovered that certain of your account information. Again, I'll read that. Right. We have discovered that certain of your account information, including your password, may have been accessed by an unauthorized party.
Right. So
it's very clumsy.
Your login name and encrypted password, but we don't think your actual name and billing address and credit card number.
I don't like that it's grammatically structured so clumsy within the first sentence. It's this first email you're sending out to everybody, and it's just you couldn't have double checked it.
Your account information is technically correct.
We have discovered that certain of your account information. I just don't like it. I don't like it. I know I'm being picky, but it seems like it's just not a very good sentence.
Grammatically correct, although you know it might have been better to word it differently.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways. Going on from that, so now, but they did send that out to all of their customers, so they, or at least all of the ones they had active email addresses for, so they're trying to get the word out there that way.
Right.
And I guess resetting the passwords was definitely a good move.
Right. Although it seems like they maybe should have done that a month ago.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as this trend started, possibly.
The other thing is they aren't forcing you to use a different password, so you could just reset it to the same password. Which is kind of
would be your own fault, but
it would be your own mistake to make. But anyways,
right. But so. I think it's because they don't have password requirement of any kind. I don't think.
I'm not sure.
When you set your password, and so it may have been hard for them to.
I feel bad for them because this is a very embarrassing thing to have, and you never want to have.
Account basically, the way their database is structured, they don't keep your old passwords, so they don't actually have your password to compare to after they've reset everybody's password to something random.
Right. I feel bad for Cryptic Studios because you know they've hopefully secured from this from now, and it's unfortunate that you know your and I's information was some of that would be in that leak.
Yep. So I got a little bit of analysis about some of the stuff of it.
Okay.
They don't give very much detail in their notice. You know, again, they use the word encryption, and you never know if they mean encryption or if they were actually doing proper hashing or.
Right. It's very vague.
If it's just like you know scrambled or you know written backwards or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you write it backwards, that's encryption. Right.
In this file, we put it in hashtags, and then we store with the password really is in this file.
So they say in quotes, even though the passwords were encrypted, it is apparent that the intruder has been able to crack some portion of the passwords in this database. So they brute forced them. So you know, if they were encrypted, that would mean there would be one key that would decrypt all the passwords. So, and because we've seen this only on a portion of accounts, it's more likely that it was brute forced.
Right.
So, their passwords were likely stored in some sort of hash.
And the ones that we know were compromised, the people that had them admitted they kind of had a weak password.
Right. Which makes, from a hash, those ones are easier to compromise. So, you know, at least it seems they had some kind of hashing going on. However, we don't have any details about what type of hashing.
Right.
But
I wish some companies would release that.
I think the only time I've ever seen it was, I think, the Gawker one, where they admitted they had just plain MD5s with no hashing.
Right. They did. But I think more often companies should because I feel like I should know, since it's my information that's been leaked, all right, tell me how locked up is it? Now, what are my chances here? I mean, I don't know if it really makes that big of a difference.
A press release probably isn't the right place for technical details like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. But... given the fact that it's been more than a year since the database was compromised before we started seeing the string of the accounts being compromised, kind of suggests that the passwords had been properly hashed, or at least somewhat hashed.
That or whoever had it just sat on it for a while then sold it to somebody. something like
right.
that.
Right. So yeah, somebody broke in and then sold it later, or it took them a while to crack the passwords.
Yeah.
So we don't know how they, if they were just plain MD5 hashes, that explains how they were much easier to crack. Because, you know, the delay suggests that they spent a significant amount of time brute forcing the passwords, but it may have just been, you know, Cryptic did something esoteric. Like, I've seen some people that do a hash, but they manually salt it with like a random string or something.
Okay.
It's the same salt for every password, but, and things like that. But the time factor of more than a year is kind of relative. If you're using one machine to crack passwords more than a year, you know, that it'd take you that long even to crack, you know, or to brute force even very weak hashing. But, you know, if you have mega machines and video cards doing it, then you could get a lot more done in that same amount of time. And also, it's like, we don't know how sophisticated the attacker actually was. If they just didn't know what rainbow tables were or how to use them, they may have spent all that time cracking MD5 hashes that they could have done with a rainbow table much quicker.
Right. Oh, yeah. Okay.
But basically, suggested by the fact that, you know, they cracked passwords that were more on the simple side, seems to suggest a brute force against the hash. We just don't know if it was a plain MD5 hash or a salted hash or a cryptographic hash or what.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if it was a cryptographically hashed MD5, so that's like what Linux uses by default, right? Mm-hmm. It's $1, $salt, the hash. You know, those are pretty secure and would be a lot harder to crack. Although now with the large-scale video cards and cloud computing, those are possible to crack in a more reasonable amount of time. And that's why most Linux distributions now support doing SSH256-based hashing with a longer salt.
Huh. I wonder if they're using, I mean, if we know they're using like ASP.NET and Microsoft SQL, can we draw conclusions as to what potential?
They may be using some built-in password hashing library.
Right, right.
I'm not familiar with ASP.NET, but it's more likely they were doing that or some MS SQL built-in encryption or hashing mechanism.
Right, okay. Hmm.
The other thing is, to explain the delay, is that the attackers likely saved up the passwords that they were able to crack for quite a while until they had a whole bunch of them so that they could compromise all those accounts very, very quickly.
Right.
So that Cryptic wouldn't take steps to, you know, if they had done one account at a time, you know, as they cracked them over the last 6 months, Cryptic probably would have noticed sooner,
right,
and would have forced this password reset sooner.
They didn't want to tip their hand, basically, kind of a thing.
Right, so by saving up as many compromised accounts as they could and then doing them all at once,
right,
then they got more out of it.
Yeah.
The risk of doing that is that as people change their passwords naturally over time or because they forget them and have to reset them, that would actually render the cracked passwords useless.
Right.
Right. So if you don't use them quickly enough, they age and expire. Or also, you know, especially with an MMO, if people stop subscribing, maybe their account goes away automatically, although most MMOs don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, but even cryptographic hashes, like proper full high strength, like Blowfish or SSH56 with the strong salt and everything,
right?
You know, eventually those can be cracked. And mm-hmm. that's why it's important to change your password periodically. Maybe not, you know, you don't have to do it once a month, but maybe once every 6 months or so, you should change your password so that if somebody does get one of these databases, if they crack your password by the time they get to it, they'll never, your password will be different by the time they can crack it.
Yeah, yeah. That was why, as soon as I started to suspect something was wrong a few weeks ago, I jumped onto the old website and changed my password right away. Just thinking, I don't want anything taken out of my account or anything like that. And I changed my, you know, I think that changes my form account.
I only ever use PayPal, so they don't have my credit card numbers.
It kind of makes me wish Cryptic offered game cards. Because, like with Tor, you can just buy game cards and I can buy them on Amazon using the affiliate link. And I, you know, that's a nice little win-win. But with Stowe, you can't buy the game cards.
Right.
Oh, that'd be nice. Huh. Well, interesting stuff. Anything else on that one?
Nope, that's about it.
All right. Well, just in case everybody hasn't gotten their backdoor quota, I do believe we have another story this week that involves a backdoor, don't we, Alan?
Yes.
What's going on?
So Arcadian, which makes Wi-Fi routers.
Yeah, okay.
That are especially popular with broadband ISPs as, you know, the router that they give you with your internet connection. Basically have a flaw in them with the WPS. Now, we talked about WPS a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And how people were using it to gain access to other to people's Wi-Fi networks.
Right.
But basically, these ones have a flaw that makes it even easier. So the old flaw was, you know, because they gave a different message, whether you were close to the right pin or not, allowed you to reduce the key space and shorten the list of numbers you had to try before you broke in. With this one, there's just a number that works no matter what.
God.
So basically, it's probably a debugging tool they built in while they were testing and building, and they forgot to take it out.
You know, TechSnap is making it so that I never want to buy another off-the-shelf router ever. Yeah. It's DDWRT or Tomato or PFSense box across the board. Commercial Wi-Fi is done. It's just, it's awful. It's Definitely. Full of holes.
So basically, any user can authenticate to your network. So, you know, you have a WPA2 super strong password, but to make it easier, you have these WPS pin numbers, right?
Okay, yeah.
But basically, if you have one of these Arcadian routers, the pin number 1234567 0 will let you in no matter what.
Oh, nice.
Including if you have disabled WPS entirely. It still works.
No.
Yeah. And this is attack is much worse than the previous WPS attacks because with the other ones, you had to press the WPS button in order to
right.
activate one of these exchanges.
Yeah.
But with this WPS static pin, no one has to press a button. You just connect to the router, send the pin, and you're in the network. You get the encryption key for the full Wi-Fi network.
It almost seems like it's done on purpose.
Yeah, well, it was. It was a debugging tool, and they just forgot to take it out.
Oh, right. You said that. Right. Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah. All right.
Yeah.
I was looking at their website, and they provide basically platforms, hardware and software, for a lot of different Wi-Fi developers. Like, a lot of manufacturers incorporate their technology into their products.
Yep. And then, you know, the worst part was that the override pin works even if you disable WPS entirely.
I think the title of this episode might be People Are Stupid, Alan. I don't know.
So they make routers mostly specifically for ISPs. And so just because this story happened to come out of Germany originally, they noted that one ISP alone has 100,000 of these deployed with their customers.
Oh my gosh.
And apparently these routers are actually quite expensive because they're, you know, have lots of features or whatever. They sell for 200 euros, which is about $275 each.
Oh my gosh.
And there's 100,000 of them in Germany alone, all of which are vulnerable to this attack.
And there's probably, you know, they could be at houses, they could be at businesses. Yeah, they've got this German online magazine here has like is following this, and they're trying to list out the models that are affected and stuff like that. And yep. they keep uncovering more models, they say here in the headline.
Right, because Arcadian uses the same software on all the routers that happens.
Wow.
So the researchers noted that the stock firmware that ships on the routers, which is 1.08, is vulnerable. But even the newest downloadable version from the website of the manufacturer, 1.16, is still vulnerable as well.
Look, we have someone in the chat room knows people that has these routers. So there you go. Go yep. take the story. We have links in the show notes. Go have some fun with your friend and screw with them before they get a chance to update. I assume they're going to have an update.
So it seems that this company might actually be publishing new firmware on at least a semi-regular basis. But, you know, these routers, 99% of them aren't going to auto-update. The user has to manually update their firmware. And, you know, most users aren't going to do that. If for no other reason than, you know, there's a good chance of bricking your $200 router when you do
it. Right. I hate that kind of stuff. And if they don't know about it, they're going to say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yep.
That's what I say. No, if it ain't broke, don't patch it.
Basically, the only available workaround is to completely disable wireless on it and just use it as a regular wired router.
I wonder if anybody out there in the... within the great range of the TechSnap broadcast, if any of those routers, you can load DDWRT on it, just do yourself a favor. Just go DDWRT. It's really a very good firmware. Alan.
And because most of these devices are white labeled, so instead of saying Arcadian on them, they will probably say the name of your ISP or something.
Right,
to that
right.
Effect. I've got the starting portions of the MAC addresses of that are assigned to Arcadian. So if your router starts with any of these MAC addresses, then it's probably from this company and likely vulnerable.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you've got those in the show notes.
Yeah.
Excellent. There you go. So people can check that against their own MAC address. Mm-hmm. All right, Alan. Well, I want to have you check something out, and that's GoDaddy.com. They are sponsoring this week's episode of TechSnap. And GoDaddy is rocking some great deals just for the month of April, which is almost over. So you got to take advantage of these deals right freaking now. First up, $5.99.com7. Enter that in at checkout and you'll get your domain, your .com for $5.99. That's a fire sale deal. I'm telling you, you got to take advantage of that while you can. And that is $5.99.com7 to get a .com for $5.99. Also, if you're doing other things like me, I bought a .me domain recently. Spring7. Boom. 15% off your order. You're doing some renewals. Use it. You're doing some domain purchases. Use that sucker.
Not very often does a code come up where you can use it on renewals, so use it up.
Yeah, and it's a great way to support the show by supporting the folks that put a little money in our pocket so we can afford to do these shows. So thank you to GoDaddy for sponsoring this show, and thank you to everybody who supports our sponsors. You can find those codes and some other links in the show notes for this episode. Check those out, and thank you again, GoDaddy, for supporting TechSnap. All right, Alan. Well, I think that's everything we have for the top of the show, correct, sir? All right, then it's time for the TechSnap feedback. And thanks for sending your emails to TechSnap@JupiterBroadcasting.com. Now, we got a big one this week because we've gotten a lot of emails about this. All of the shows have across the entire network, and that is... Alan, are you ready for the question?
Yes.
Hey, guys, says the entire internet. Why can't I download Jupiter Broadcasting shows? It appears the world is ending. And of course, not all Jupiter Broadcasting shows aren't available for download. Specifically, the direct video links in the show notes haven't been working over the last few days as a result of some changes that Blip.tv is making. Now, most RSS feed readers are still working, and the web player is still working, and all of the audio feeds. And the YouTube stuff is all still working, but the HD, mobile, and large videos that are usually in the show notes for a lot of people have not been able to download them. And unfortunately, that's just a result of some decisions that our current CDN has made, and there's not really much we can do about it. But we are going to move off of them. There are some links in the show notes as well that you can go to until we get everything all switched over, because a lot of people that are experiencing the most bulk of the problems are Android users, and a couple of the podcast managers out there have some workarounds for that. What Blip TV is doing now, and tell me what you think about this.
So what it looks like is when you try to download a video, you get a very small video file that's 1 second that says, this video is only available as an embed.
I'll go pull that up. So, of course, what they're doing to do that, which just seems foolish to me, but maybe as somebody who does offer streaming services yourself, you could tell me if I'm wrong here, but they're doing user agent detection for whoever's requesting the file. And based on the user agent, if it's a web browser, they're denying it because they don't want you to do it outside of their player because they monetize in their player. So, like right now, I'm going to, I'm trying to download an episode of Torqued, and instead I get that this video is only available in the Blip player. Search Blip or your favorite search engine for a viable alternatives, which is such crap.
Right. So basically,
user agent detection, and then based on that, so they detected Chrome here and they said, nope, can't have the file.
Right. So basically, they only want to, basically, for backwards compatibility, they're only allowing iTunes and a few other podcatchers to download the files directly.
Right. Otherwise, they want you to use the Flash player.
Right. Because they want the embedded version because then they can actually have the chance to put ads in or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
And, it just seems odd to make a change like that kind of unannounced.
Yeah, they've done a few other things like that where it's just been like, boom, they've made the change. And so I kind of was suspecting that they're, reeling things back in because they're having cost issues and things like that. And
well, basically their business model is not sustainable.
Right. They're trying to monetize their bandwidth usage with ads, and it's just not going to work.
And that doesn't work when you offer direct downloads that don't have an ad.
So they're killing those. So, of course, all of our stuff, though, for years now, has been distributed through Blip.tv for the videos, and so now all those links aren't working all of a sudden.
Yeah. Because, TV's business model has mostly been, producers pay a small nominal fee.
Right.
I think it's like $9 a month or something.
Right, right.
And they basically get unlimited bandwidth.
Right.
But so, that is always the story when somebody tries to sell you unlimited anything. there's actually a limit.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's that, you know, their bandwidth is costing them, you know, Jupiter Broadcasting's bandwidth bill for all the people downloading the shows is definitely a lot more than $9.
Yeah.
And it's probably a lot more than $9 plus all the advertising revenue they make off all the shows.
Right, right. Yep, it is, I'm sure.
So
it actually, though, turns out to be a pretty hard problem to solve. Because these MP4 files are huge, right? Some of them are 700 megs. They range from about 700 megs. Let's say they range from 800 megabytes to 200 megabytes. And when you're distributing those kinds of files, and the way a nature of a show release is everyone kind of comes at once at first, and then it sort of peters off over time and then kind of just levels off and reaches a steady point where it's a much more manageable demand.
That last bit's called the long tail.
Right, the long tail. And the issue with that is most really all standard web servers can't really fill that role. So you can't go get, like, I got suggestions, go to HostGator or go to Bluehost or go to GoDaddy and get one of their unlimited bandwidth, unlimited storage servers and just host them all there. But all of those servers would immediately hit bottlenecks when about the 12th or 13th or 14th person started downloading a file. They'd kind of probably just put their hands up
and almost
say,
all those services that include unlimited traffic like that have a clause in their terms of service that say, if your usage degrades our service for our other users, we will kick you off.
Right.
Right. So they offer you unlimited, but if you ever use any bandwidth at all, they will kick you off.
So the second number, like two suggestion is BitTorrent. Why don't you just BitTorrent the files,
guys?
But, you know, the issue with BitTorrent, the primary issue with BitTorrent is RSS clients don't support BitTorrent for downloads.
Specifically, all the people that want to download these, all the people that are having the issue, they're trying to download these on a mobile device.
Right.
You can't really run a torrent on a mobile device.
Doesn't support mobile devices, which is shooting yourself in the foot in this day and age if you roll something out and don't support mobile devices. And also, a lot of ISPs throttle the crap out of BitTorrent, so it makes the download experience crappy. Plus, when you have that long tail portion, once a lot of the main people are done downloading, there's going to be an issue with the amount of seeding, and less popular shows or new shows that don't have an established audience yet would suffer, and it would make it hard for people to download. So BitTorrent might serve a role in some capacity, but it's definitely not a primary answer, meaning we'd still have to come up with some sort of solution for the majority of the demand. So really, that kind of thing requires what's called a CDN or a content distribution network, because then you're pushing the files out all over the places. And of course, Scale Engine is one of those such places.
Unlike a typical web server, our CDN servers are connected at a gigabit or 10 gigabits rather than 100 megabits. And we have lots of the servers and they're spread out all over the place. So when, you know, 2,000 people show up to download the file as soon as it's released, we can handle that.
Right. And in a lot of cases, it'll be downloaded from a server that's closer to their actual physical location.
So that'll get better speed.
Right. So when you do a one single server, of course, then it's always hosted from wherever that one single server is. Well, so if I did a server that was hosted in Texas and then somebody in the UK went to download the file, that's extremely unfair to them because they have a very slow download versus something like a CDN where they would actually be downloading it from a server that's in their country.
Right. Or at least nearby.
Right. Or nearby. Yeah. So that's the kind of change we're going to be making here on the back end. Is we'll be moving over. It looks like we'll probably be going to Scale Engine because Alan's got a great service and great prices. Mm-hmm. And we'll be sort of over the next week, I hope all of the new shows will be delivered using that. And then I'm going to have to figure out something for the back catalog. All of the in-page plays work right now. And it's honestly, I just don't know if I can A, afford to move the whole back catalog, and B, the amount of time that would take, because I would have to make new mobile versions of those too.
Well, it depends. Like some of the files, if we can trick the user agent, we could download them directly from Blip TV.
True. Yeah. True. Although their quality sucks, but I'd be willing to do it to save time. But then the whole problem though is getting those. I guess if it could be done server side and do like some sort of RSS feed pull or something like that.
Yep.
Maybe that'd be the way to do it, is pulling it through the RSS feed. But either way, it's a massive migration. We're talking a huge... So I don't know how the back catalog will be available, in what form. It'll definitely be available in the web player and on YouTube, but I'm still working that out. And I'll probably also be discontinuing the large format. So all shows right now, they generally have an HD format, a large format, which is perfect for tablets, and then a mobile version, which is perfect for phones. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that mobile version, and I'm going to try to just make it a higher quality, better file that scales better. So mobile version will work for phones and tablets. And then you'll have the HD version, which works on newer tablets and, of course, your computer and your TV and all those kinds of things.
Right.
So we'll only have two video files, but that'll save us some bandwidth and that'll save us some storage costs, because now, you know, now we're going to pay for every single transfer and all the files, whereas with Blip TV it was one flat rate. And that's why Blip TV was so great. But, you know, of course, that's
why
and,
it's not sustainable either, right?
Exactly.
They were a startup, they got startup funding, they ran for a while, but... You know, they introduced a really low price to try to get people in, but they're.
And
I'm
like,
surprised we haven't seen a price hike at least. But
yeah,
basically, the amount you're paying is so disconnected from the amount you're using that, you know, the, no price hike would really make sense.
I guess I wish they could have offered something, but yeah, you're probably right. Yeah. There probably isn't something. That says,
well, because when we look at a couple of different CDNs, there's ones like Brightcove, $1.75 per gigabyte,
right?
Or Longtail Video has one that the guys that make JW Player, one of the open source video players.
Yeah.
They're about $1 a gigabyte. You tried Rackspace, that's 18 cents a gigabyte. People recommended Amazon. It's like, if you use just S3, that's 12 cents a gigabyte. But they were recommending using EC2s to run a whole bunch of servers. On top of not being all available, the running the server instances cost money, right? You pay per hour for those.
Yeah.
And if you're going to have some in like Ireland and so on, those cost more per minute or per hour than the ones in the US. The cheapest ones, running one of the cheapest ones 24/7 costs $200+ a month.
I like what, you know, Binar in the chat room too is saying, you know, we could do something like a community torrent project. That's probably a good idea. I'll probably try to start working with people in the community to that, because that'll just be another distribution means for people that want to use that. I don't see anything wrong with that. That seems like a
something
good idea.
With torrents, so that they're, it's an option for people that can do it to alleviate the bandwidth costs, and
exactly.
For people that can't, then we'll still have the CDN.
Yeah, exactly. So that's probably, that might be what, and then also there's even some things that I was even thinking about doing something like a URL redirector. So like right now on Torqued and Cybyte, I have a URL for the MP4 file for the HD version, and that actually on the back end redirects to archive.org, and then on another one it redirects to Rackspace. So I'm actually using a little redirector to make one URL that I can put in the RSS feed and I can put up on the link on the site, and then using a WordPress plugin, which is a little hokey, I'm actually sending it to the actual destination file. So that would be another way, is to prime the CDN with content, and so the most in-demand stuff, like the current two-week catalog, could be on the CDN. And then after 2 weeks, they would get moved to archive.org, and I would just change the redirector. The links would all stay the same everywhere. And then people that are coming 2 weeks later, when demand would theoretically be lower, would be pulling from archive.org, which is essentially free.
Right. Well, even if you were using archive, that would be very handy for the scale engine side of it, because we can use a different pool of servers. Basically, a lot of our edge servers are designed for very in-demand content.
Right.
And they don't have that much storage space.
Right.
So if we use those to serve the popular stuff, and then once something's 2 weeks old, it goes to our archive version of the CDN, which is designed for rarer downloads of big files rather than...
Oh, yeah. Like that. So don't move it to archive. Because see, that I like that, because the problem with archive.org is sometimes it's down. And there's no SLA, and I feel bad because I'm sort of like mooching off of a free service. So I was thinking of some... So the only problem is that it's using a WordPress plugin...
We would replace that with something else.
Yeah, it would have to be something. Yeah, exactly. But that seems like another way to go, because, you know, while the files always get downloaded, it's really the first 2 weeks of the episode's life that it gets downloaded the heaviest. And then after that, it sort of trails off. And and then, you know, it's like, yeah, exactly. Why pay for prime real estate if you could move it back to the suburbs?
Well, it's more that it costs us more to serve files that are not popular from the edge. Because at the edge, our servers... Basically, they only have, you know, so much storage space on the edge server. Most of ours are only about 500 gigabytes, but some of them are more. And so when you request an episode that server hasn't served recently, it will have to go to our storage server and download a copy to that server and then send it to you. Now, it streams it so that you don't have to wait for it to download before it starts. But so if an episode's only going to be downloaded once because it's like a year old, then we're actually using twice the bandwidth to serve that. So for the older stuff, we would work around that and serve it from like an archive server rather than...
All right. Well, that seems like a good way to go. And that is a kind of a two-stage approach. So that's what's going on with the files. It's not a simple problem, but it sounds like it's a problem. We're working towards a solution. It's, of course, something we got to try to figure out kind of fast, because Blip TV has already flipped the switch and they just did it.
They didn't give us any warning.
No.
Tried to sort this
and
out
I,
ahead of
I've had a, I've had a, I've had a very good dialogue with their, with a great rep from there who's been fully, you know, he's been upfront what's going on, and he's been you know, working with me really well. I can't really complain from a customer service standpoint once I contacted them, but I do kind of wish they would have given me like a 30 days heads up, or even a 2 week, or maybe even 5 days. That would have been great, instead of just like all of a sudden it just
flipping
not working. Yeah,
and blocking a lot of your users from subscribing.
Well, and it kills the numbers. Yep. You know, it kills the download numbers.
Yes, some of these people are not going to bother to resubscribe.
Right. So it's a real pain in the butt, and it hurts the shows too. So I want to get it fixed as fast as possible. But so hopefully we'll have good news for that in next week's episode of TechSnap. All right, Alan, are we all done with the feedback?
Yep.
All right, then that means it's time for the TechSnap Roundup. Welcome to the TechSnap Roundup. Yeah, that's what that crazy music means. Yeah, the roundup for stories that didn't quite make it into the top of the show. Or we were just going to give you some links that you could follow up on your own and do some further reading, or sometimes some follow-up. And they're almost always exclusively powered by links.techsnap.tv, our awesome TechSnap subreddit that is being posted with tons of news stories every single day. Go check that out if you're a news hound. And a lot of those make it to the show, and we thank everyone who submits and everyone who votes up on the stories. Alan, are you ready for the roundup, sir?
Yep.
Okay. First story on the roundup is a CISPA follow-up story. The Obama administration announces that they oppose the CISPA cyber bill and are considering vetoing it if it comes across Obama's desk. So this is definitely good, right? This actually first came from Secretary Hillary, and the downside, I would say, to this story is that it seems to me that it's actual, in reality, just being used as propaganda against Iran and Syria. I'll just put that out there. Obama has also authorized sanctions against surveillance tech in Syria and Iran based on the principles that they are rejecting CISPA on, and because Iran's government uses those forms of monitoring, they are blocking the sale of IT equipment and things like that to Iran.
Right. So they're blocking the sale of IT surveillance equipment to Syria and Iran because they use it to spy on people. Which
is made in the United States, and I'm sure is being sold to the United States government right now.
Right. Well, you know, most of this hardware is dual use, where it has legitimate uses as well.
All that means is the business is going to go to China. And I don't know why we aren't then implying the same restrictions and sanctions on China, since China does the same type of behavior Iran does in terms of internet monitoring.
Right, but they build their own hardware, most likely.
Maybe. I think it's just a little... I think it's a little BS, but I also then, at the same time, am happy that Obama is standing out against CISPA. And I really hope that if this is political rhetoric, I hope it's political rhetoric that actually makes him veto it, because he did come out against the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, and then signed it. So we'll see what actually happens there, but I am hopeful, and because it is an election year, and because he is using those principles to then justify sanctions against Iran and Syria, we should have enough of a reason for him not to sign CISPA. And generally, once Obama comes out and says, I'm not going to support it, then it tends to die. At least that's what happened with SOPA. Although that's not what happened with NDAA.
Right. And, you know, there's still the other one, I forget what it's called, and there will always be another cybersecurity bill.
Yes.
And so
it's become pretty clear that this thing isn't going to die, and it's just going to become a constant fight. All right, Alan, you ready for the next story on the roundup?
Yeah, that one's mine. There's a funny story from the International Business Times of a company that sent out an email to fire an employee. So it's, you know, generic email about how, you know, we have to let you go, pack all your stuff up in a box.
They sent it to the entire company?
Somehow they accidentally sent it to every employee instead of the one person they were trying to terminate.
Oh my gosh, that is so funny.
So every single employee got an email saying, you're fired.
Could you imagine people like checking on their phones, people sitting at their desk? What the? What? I mean, that is great. And must have caused a big stirrup. Have you ever done that? Have you ever like replied all when you're ranting or CC'd the wrong person?
Not really? Usually my problem is I forget to reply all, and somebody doesn't get the message that I was trying to send.
Oh, I have replied all by mistake or sent a CC to the wrong person, like to the same first name, different last names, kind of thing, and it's embarrassing.
Yes.
All right, Alan.
Well, I'm just wondering how you accidentally sent an email to all employees.
Yeah. You know what the best practice is my wife, Angela, whenever she's composing an email, she leaves the to line and the CC lines and the BCC lines completely blank until she's composed the entire email. And the last thing she does is fill in the to, so that way she can be completely cognizant of who she's filling it into. Like, she must have done the same thing at some point. Are you ready to talk about the next story?
Sure.
You actually gave us a warning about this a few episodes back, almost a month ago or more. But Iran has announced that their oil industry has been attacked by malware. You actually said that we might very well see oil platforms become a target of malware a few episodes back. This is a little different. This looks like what actually happened is the web server of one of the or the big oil company in Iran was infected. It was contained in a DMZ. Their webpage was spreading some crap, but the actual oil industry machinery that controls oil pumping and things like that wasn't impacted. This is being reported on by Bloomberg, and they say, based on information currently available, it would be very premature to suggest that this was a targeted attack against either Iran or its systems. They said,
It's you know, sounds like a standard web server attack that happens to every web server.
They said,
was just bad at patching.
Indeed, it would be bad form to make a comparison to Stuxnet. Yeah. It seems to be just more of your standard run-of-the-mill malware infection. Though that didn't stop a lot of news agencies from calling the big... Well, I mean, you could see the headline here. Iran in oil industry hit by malware attack. All you need between...
That sounds like, you know, there were pipes spewing oil out into the ocean.
Right.
And it's like, no, some script kiddie noticed that they were running an old version of Apache and pwned it or whatever.
That's just missing the word like massive or dramatic or disastrous. Ooh, if they could put disastrous in that headline, then they'd have a really good one.
Yeah.
All right, Alan, the next story on the roundup is yours. And I actually think you called this one like last week.
I called this one last week. Yeah. A security researcher has discovered a flaw in the Samsung smart TVs while he was trying to play a trick on his brother. And basically, he managed to make the Samsung TV go into an endless reboot loop.
Yeah, of course.
And I mean, so basically, he found two different vulnerabilities. One was basically a buffer overflow where he could execute code on the TV. And the other one would just cause the TV to endlessly reboot and basically disable the TV.
You know what's going to be obnoxious is when malware starts spraying to TVs that displays ads and pop-ups on your TV. How awful will that be?
Yeah.
And you know, these things are running Linux.
If you don't use it, you shouldn't use the wireless adapter on your TV.
Right. Well, my TV has an Ethernet port. So
yes. Well, the one my dad bought has an Ethernet port, but they sold him with it a USB Wi-Fi adapter for the TV that would allow it to use the Wi-Fi, so you don't want to have to run an Ethernet cable to your TV.
Right.
But that also means that your neighbor or random guy driving by, you know, war driving by your house or whatever, could pwn your TV.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we haven't talked about Configure in a while, but Microsoft was in the news headlines this week saying two basic security steps might have stopped infections. What's going on here?
But basically, yeah, they said that as far as they could tell from their research, every single infection of the Configure worm was the result of either a weak password that was brute forced or a vulnerability in Windows that Microsoft had already released a patch for and that the end user had just not patched.
Well, I mean, yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, yes, but it's basically 100% of the Configure infections shouldn't have
happened. Well, okay. All right. That is
followed.
That is an interesting statistic.
Been up to date on their patches and had decent passwords.
Does this feel a little bit, though, like Microsoft's like, hey, guys, just so you know, that thing that you all forgot about, I just want to point out it wasn't really totally our fault. It wasn't, I mean, kind of our fault, but not totally our fault.
It's
just so you guys know.
The more important message here is to make sure that you install all the patches and have a strong password.
Patch your ass.
Because patching your system up to date and keeping it that way will ensure that most of the time you don't get this malware, right? Malware is based on finding these vulnerabilities and then, you know, it's all following after, like jumping on the trend, more and more malware.
I mean, almost all of the most common malware, though, is taking advantage of low-hanging fruit that users just aren't being diligent about their patches.
The zero-day ones are fairly rare, and those usually seem to happen more, you know, that's Stuxnet and the government and that VPN we saw, you know, publishing. Yeah. They find 0 days and then sell them for a lot of money. Well, people that make malware that, you know, sells you fake antivirus programs or whatever, they're not spending a lot of money to hack your computer. They're just hacking a lot of people that are not very smart.
They're just casting a wide net.
Right, because it's easier to convince someone like that to pay you $40 for your antivirus software than someone that actually knows how to patch their computer.
It's true. Unfortunately, there's there is a technical divide there, and the people who
With XP and 7, it's fairly hard to not update your computer. You'd have to actually choose to do it.
Right, yeah, unless, you know what it
but
is, though?
I know a lot of users get annoyed by having to restart for an update.
Or, like, the family member turns, oh, I'll turn that off for you. Let me just turn that annoying thing off there. God darn thing.
Yeah.
All right, Alan, well, the next story on the roundup has me braced for complete drama. Moving from Gmail to Hotmail, the disastrous conclusion. What's going on here?
Yes. So Microsoft was trying to get some attention back to Hotmail and how, it's not as bad as it used to be.
Hey, guys, remember Hotmail? Hey, guys, Hotmail over here. Do you remember us?
So basically, Microsoft asked a couple of bloggers to try Hotmail again after having used Gmail for years. But the guy's Hotmail account got hacked because he noticed the people on his contacts were getting... really strange emails and so on.
No.
But because it's all integrated with Microsoft Live, that also meant they compromised his Xbox account, the account he logs into his Windows machine with, Microsoft Live Mail, and everything else that uses Microsoft Live, including the Metro store.
Yeah, the Metro store and the Windows 8 desktop use your Windows Live ID. Exactly. Now, we should be fair, though. If a Google account got compromised, they'd have access to your docs, your Gmail, possibly your Android device, your market account to buy apps, those kinds of things.
In this case, the guy's biggest concern was that his credit card was in his Xbox account.
Yeah, sure. Well, my credit card's in my Google Market, Android Market account.
So. I don't know, I use mine there. But the interesting note at the bottom is that, the guy tries to defend it. But it turns out his password was only 7 characters, all lowercase.
That's kind of his fault.
Yeah. I'm doubting that it was just brute forced. Right?
Might have been just guessed.
You'd have to guess the right email address as well, though.
Okay, that's true.
It seems suspicious. Like, I see this happening a lot. MSN and Hotmail accounts getting hacked. And I just don't see it being brute forced because, obviously, Microsoft would pop up a CAPTCHA after so many failed login attempts.
Yeah, right.
And blocking IPs. So it seems they have to be some other way of getting these accounts.
Well, now that could be the case of a Trojan or a malware, because that is a big enough target that it would be people would have incentive to write malware to capture that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's some sort of intrinsic flaw that Microsoft just hasn't really nailed down yet.
I'm not sure exactly what the problem is, but they definitely were having a problem there.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So links to all of those stories are in the show notes. Just go over to jupiterbroadcasting.com and look for episode 55 of TechSnap. You'll see the video posted. And then just scroll down past the download links that are hopefully working down to the show notes, where you'll have links to everything we talked about. I think that's the show, yeah?
There's the one more point.
Okay.
It came up in the news again, although we've discussed it once or twice before, but the FBI shutting down the DNS servers that they run.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We were going to talk about it. Okay, yeah. So that's kind of a story that's been spreading around. People might have seen this headline, the internet shut down.
Yes. And I've seen this headline get overblown 3 or 4 times already.
Yep.
As the date comes close every time, and then the FBI bumps it because of the immediate attention around it.
Right.
But basically, the FBI busted a malware ring that was called DNS Switcher. And basically, when it compromised your computer, it changed your DNS servers in your Windows settings to be their DNS servers.
Right.
Where they would then hijack your traffic for Google, PayPal, and a bunch of other sites. Right. Specifically, they're after your Google searches so they could sell the ads on the search page. You would actually get a fake Google. Anyway, so when the FBI took over that, they didn't just shut down the DNS servers because that would have left everybody infected with no internet. They set up temporary DNS servers. They were just going to be for a couple of months to let people get, their computer fixed.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a lot of people who have their computer infected and still have these rogue DNS servers as their DNS.
Yeah, the FBI estimates that somewhere between 150 to 360,000 people that are using the FBI's DNS right now.
Right. And the FBI is paying for this, and they're like, well, we need to stop at some point.
The FBI claims they're spending $87,000 a month running this. Now, I don't know how you spend $87,000 a month running DNS, but that's what they say.
That's for that many people, it's like, yeah, I could do that.
I guess for that many people, I could see it being costly, but you think it's that costly?
Yes. I could do it for 20 times less, at least.
Yeah, exactly. Also, so the way the headline went, and I blogged about this over at filterfree.me because it just struck me because I knew we'd already talked about this. And what day did I post this? On April 22nd, in a 24-hour period, there was 545 articles written just on that one day. And look at some of these headlines. Don't lose internet in July. Infected PCs may drop. I love one of them is like, here it is. The FBI reports you're in danger. How about that one? Hundreds of thousands may lose access. That's a good one.
I've seen worse ones. There's like the FBI is going to shut down your internet.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, the internet is going to be shut down is one of the headlines here.
Yes.
Is your computer infected? That's another headline.
Well, that one's a little more reasonable. Right?
How about virus shuts down the internet? Do you like that one?
Yeah.
Virus is literally one.
The FBI on their website, I have a link in the show notes, has a database of every IP that's hit their rogue DNS server. So you can enter your IP and see if you've ever used the rogue DNS server so you know if you're infected.
There you go.
Although, there you go. If you're technically capable enough, you can just check what your DNS servers are. Most likely you have DHCP and it should be set to automatic. If it's statically defined to some random IPs, that's probably not good. If you're in there anyway, you should probably switch to using Google DNS or OpenDNS.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you this, Alan.
Remember 8.8.8.8 and 8.8.4.4.
8.8.8, yeah, that's Google. Why aren't they just doing some sort of redirect to a page explaining that this service is about
That's why don't they just hijack the DNS and make every resolve through
They already have hijacked the DNS, in a sense. They have the DNS. They're not roguing it.
They're actually turning real results.
Right, but I'm just saying, they've been doing it. They could.
Yeah, so why not have it send all traffic to a page explaining it? It seems a little weird.
And why keep doing press release after press release after press release about this? Really? And they keep doing it in these big batches on slow news days, and then all these people write up, maybe to get attention.
Funding about their, to stop more malware, which is probably, I don't know, it seems very weird, but I just keep seeing this giant media frenzy around it, and it happens over and over again, because this date that they were going to shut it down keeps getting moved back.
Yeah.
And every time, you know, so I linked to somebody asked me this question on Google Plus, and I tried to explain it all to them because the headline there was FBI will shut down the internet on March 8th.
Right.
And they were very concerned about this. And so I was trying to explain what the problem was. And I go into quite a bit of detail about it.
Mashable released a video about it over a month ago, explaining what's going on. Well, I mean,
I explained it in February and that's when it was already old news.
Yeah. Yeah. So don't buy into the hype. The internet isn't being shut down. Although if you are infected, check out the link in the show notes. Go get your IP checked.
Well, if you've been infected for this long and haven't figured it out, you're probably doing something wrong.
You're probably not watching TechSnap.
Yeah.
You're probably not watching TechSnap. But maybe
if your computer is infected and it's been that long and you're missing like all the updates, your machine is probably so far gone, you should just reformat and start fresh.
Yeah. And maybe just go get an iPad. Just call it good. I mean, because then, you know, that's a little easier.
I'd never recommend that.
But we want to get the word out there because there's probably people out there who have friends or family that they should probably check.
Yeah.
I mean, at the time when the FBI took this thing over, they said it was 560,000 people that were using DNS. And I'm sure, you know what's funny, is that really seems to be the solution. Forget CISPA. Just run DNS for the United States and then just monitor everywhere everybody's going right then and there.
Well, that's what CISPA was about.
That's true. CISPA, then they'll just go to the ISP and say, give us all your DNS logs. That is much more efficient. You're right. They've they've privatized spying on citizens. Oh my God,
What CISPA was specifically was making it illegal to do things that would stop them or interfere with them monitoring what you were doing.
CISPA is
like
literally
trying to use an encrypted DNS server.
CISPA is literally going to give them that information. It is literally privatizing surveillance.
Well, it's like we said, it was about indemnifying the ISPs against the no wiretapping law,
right,
and about making it illegal to circumvent their ability to monitor you.
Yeah.
Because we've seen this like in, I think it was Turkey. Maybe it wasn't Turkey. I forget. Some Middle Eastern country. A little bit more moderate than some of them. But anyway, they made it illegal to use VPNs or any type of encryption because it prevented the government from spying on you.
Dude, that was India. That was India.
No, they were considering it, but I think it was Turkey actually did it.
Okay. All right.
Or maybe it was Pakistan. I think it was Pakistan.
Well,
I forget.
There
you we go. Covered it on TechSnap, so it's in the show notes.
55 episodes, people. It's hard to keep track of all that.
Them all straight.
All right. Well, I think that's the whole show, right, Alan? All right, everyone. Well, TechSnap is live on Thursday afternoons at 1 p.m. And you can join our awesome jblive.tv chat room and give us your ideas and your input on, of course, chat room saying Pakistan. So there you go.
Yes.
Pakistan.
I don't know why I couldn't think of that. I'm reading a book about Pakistan right now.
I think I thought it was India because they're also the same ones that were trying to get access to the BlackBerry encryption protocol for RIM.
Right. They wanted to spy on BlackBerries.
Yeah. So join the chat room and correct us live as we're going. And of course, you can always download TechSnap in hopefully any format you want over at jupiterbroadcasting.com right there in the show notes. Also, subscribe to the RSS feeds, because if you are having troubles downloading, the RSS feeds are one of the few ways that are actually still working pretty well for everybody. And then you get the show weekly as well. All right, Alan. Well, thanks for the great show.
Yep.
All right, and thank you to everyone for tuning into this week's episode of TechSnap, and we'll see you right back here next week.